Chapter 2 Part 2 The Way of Self-Knowledge Verses 39 and 40
Esha te bihita sankhye buddhiryoge tvimamshunu buddhya yukto yaya partha karma bandham prahasyasi Neha bhikrama nashosti pratyavayo na vidyate svalpamapyasya dharmasya trayate mahato bhayat
This wisdom I have told you according to the philosophy of Sankhya, now hear it according to Yoga, the wisdom joined with which, O son of Pritha, you will abandon the bondage of karma. There is no loss of initiative on this path, nor is there any possibility of failure. Even a little of this discipline protects one from great danger and fear. Sri Krishna has taught Arjuna the philosophy of Sankhya. Which helps one to know that which is the self, and to distinguish it from the non-self. Now he begins his teaching of yoga science. Sankhya philosophy teaches that the self of all is eternal and immortal, and that the world of objects is transitory and changeable. Sankhya is a philosophy, whereas yoga is the profound science of sadhana that applies that philosophy. Sankhya and yoga go hand in hand. Without sadhana, philosophy remains mere speculation, and without philosophy, sadhana remains without a goal. When Sankhya and Yoga are combined, one experiences the philosophical truths directly. They are no longer mere intellectual concepts. By practicing yoga, one can apply the philosophical truths of Sankhya in his daily life. The path of yoga teaches those disciplines of sadhana that help the aspirant in self-unfoldment. Yoga in action means well-disciplined and skillful action done in a non-attached way, without any expectation of the fruits of one's actions. Sri Krishna, the exemplary teacher of yoga science, explains how to develop equanimity and perform actions skillfully. In the Isha Upanishad, the Vedic sages advocate the same way of performing actions. Find delight by renouncing the fruits of your actions. Do not covet. If you wish to live a long life, learn to perform your actions without attachment. While following the path of Dharma and truth, one can temporarily become confused and commit a mistake, but the quest for Dharma and truth will in itself lead him back to right understanding. He will once more perform his duties according to his Dharma. Following his Dharma helps one to become one-pointed in his thoughts and actions, whereas dissipated and endless are the thoughts and actions of the irresolute. Furthermore, the conscious effort one makes to follow his Dharma has an enduring effect. It is motivation that is important here. Having a pure motive, one will perform his duty well. In the path of sadhana, no effort is in vain. All sincere efforts bear their fruits in the unconscious mind according to the inevitable law of karma. Impressions live in the unconscious, in the storehouse of one's memory. Even a little sadhana practiced with sincere effort leaves deep imprints in the unconscious mind. Those impressions help and guide the sadhaka whenever he goes off the path. The conscious part of the mind is but a small part of the whole. It is helpful in communicating with the external world, but has very little use on the inward journey. If the conscious part of the mind is trained not to create further barriers, then sadhana is useful. Yoga sadhana alone has explored all the unknown levels of life and is thus useful for knowing the levels of the unconscious and for training the totality of the mind. Although modern depth psychology has come a long way in the last 100 years in its recognition and exploration of a few of the layers of the unconscious mind, there is no training program in any of the educational and therapeutic systems of the world that can help one know the unconscious to the extent that yoga science can. If one does not know himself on all dimensions, how can he understand his relationships in the external world? Sadhana alone is the way of knowing, understanding, and analyzing the internal states and one's relationship to the external world. While treading the path of the inner world, The sadhaka comes in touch with those potentialities that guide him unconsciously, or sometimes through dreams, and at other times consciously. Fearlessness thus increases, and self-reliance is strengthened. He is fully protected by the finer forces that exist, although he is not aware of them because of his extroverted nature. No danger can ever befall the sincere sadhaka in his exploration of the inner realms. The sadhaka is completely protected if he is fully dedicated to the goal of self-realization. Verse 41.
Vyavasayatmika buddhir ekeha kurunandana bahushakha hyanantascha buddhayo vyavasayina.
O Prince of the Kurus, there is only one determinative wisdom, and the intellects of those who do not have such decisive wisdom are unending, with many branches. Merely knowing what to do without one pointedness of mind will not lead one to perform his duty accurately. Therefore, the desired results will not be attained. Just as profound knowledge of what to do is essential, so having a one-pointed mind is equally essential. The modern student tends to know intellectually, but does not make sincere efforts to develop one-pointedness of mind. Thus his mind remains scattered, and all his actions result in disappointment. For lack of a one-pointed mind, the modern student jumps from one path to another because he does not understand that it is his scattered mind that is creating barriers for him. He thinks the barriers are outside. Assuming that another path or goal will be better is trickery played by the mind. One already knows what is right, but he does not know how to put it into practice. In childhood, the fundamentals of all great truths are taught to us. Then we spend energy in trying to apply those truths, but we fail. We do not realize that with systematic practice, we can succeed. The key point of practice, as well as of success, lies in one-pointedness of mind. Attention is the first step on the ladder to develop one-pointedness of mind. One must pay wholehearted attention to all of the things he does, from morning until evening. The aspirant should also understand why he is acting in a particular way. Actions should not be performed as a reaction without understanding why one does them. The human mind is prone to be reactionary if it is not trained, and an untrained mind creates disorder, disease, and confusion. If one does something with full attention, he will increase his awareness and ability to perform his duty. If one forms the habit of attending fully to whatever he is doing, the mind will become trained, and eventually, concentration will become effortless. It is a great quality for one to be able to express his knowledge through his speech and action with a one-pointed mind. Thousands of thoughts remain waiting to be entertained. The purpose of sadhana is to attend to those thoughts in a systematic manner so that they do not create unrest in the inner world. Arjuna is instructed to make his mind one-pointed before performing his duty. Verses
42-44. Vedavadaratapartha nanyadastiti vadinaha kamatmanaha swargaparaha janma karma phalapradam kriya vishesha bahulam bhogaishwarya gatim prati bhogaishwarya prasaktanam tayapa hrutachetasam vyavasayatmika buddhihi samadhau navidhiyate.
This is the flowery speech that the unwise speak, absorbed in the discussions of the Vedas, saying, there is nothing else. Totally identified with their desire, intent upon heaven, uttering the speech that leads them to the fruit of karma in the form of rebirth, ample in specific rituals resulting in pleasure and power. Since they are attached to pleasure and power, and their minds are plundered by that speech of theirs, their determinative wisdom does not succeed in leading to samadhi. Theologians, scholars, and priests theorize and write commentaries on scriptures such as the Vedas. Yet however profound their theoretical knowledge may be, they cannot assimilate that knowledge and live according to it without sadhana. Intellectualization is easy, but sadhana is difficult. Many scholars make erudite speeches on the Vedic verses, but they themselves have not realized the full meaning of those verses. Therefore, Sri Krishna teaches Arjuna to practice and assimilate the knowledge. He urges him not to be foolish, like those who talk on the Vedas but do not practice the teachings of the Vedas. Such scholars and priests are enveloped with self-interest. Their actions are directed toward mundane and temporal gains and the attainment of heavenly joys. As a result, they become caught in the snare of births and deaths. Many religious leaders have forgotten the profound meaning of the great scriptures and merely use them for their own convenience. Motivated to attain external pleasures, they involve the innocent in rituals. Much of the misery we find in society is because of unwise teachings spread by such religious teachers. It is an irony of human history that religious leaders often practice religion to achieve selfish ends. In fact, it has become a tradition that unfortunately misleads the vast majority of society. A rare few are aware of the fallacies and follies of such selfish leaders and thus prefer to isolate themselves and practice sadhana. But how many such people are there in the world, and how much good can they do with their teachings and writings when the vast majority of religionists preach and teach meaningless rituals that rob the intelligent of the wisdom of the great scriptures? The sages who have seen the truth face to face and who were able to touch infinity have always warned sadhakas that real knowledge comes from earnest sadhana, which leads to direct experience, and not from mere study of the scriptures. While intellectual knowledge is often used for selfish ends, those sages knew that truth and selflessness are one. Selflessness is an acquired taste. When one finds delight in being selfless, he can lead, serve, and love others, and even change the course and destiny of nations. Selfishness feeds the ego, but selflessness leads one to higher levels of consciousness. Verses 45 and 46.
Traigunya Vishaya Veda Nistraigunyo Bhavarjuna Nirdvando Nityasattvastho Niryogakshema Atmavan Yavanartha Udapane Sarvata Sampludodake Tavan Sarveshu Vedeshu Brahmanasya Vijanataha.
The subject of the Vedas is the world consisting of the three gunas. O Arjuna, be free of the constituent gunas, free of the pairs of opposites. Dwell in the eternal essence, disinterested in worldly and otherworldly success, having cultivated the self. The purpose that is served by a small well, as compared to water flooding all around, that much is the meaning in all the Vedic rituals for a son of God who has supreme knowledge. Sri Krishna is not condemning the Vedas, but is advising Arjuna to go beyond the three attributes of the human mind to attain a state of equanimity. The human mind is composed of three gunas, qualities, sattva, rajas, and tamas. The Vedas explain that these three qualities are present in all that exists in the phenomenal world, and so are also found in all human beings, though in different grades and degrees. When the sadhaka understands that the animal tendency is destructive, unhelpful, and of a tamasic nature, he increases his awareness of his human potentials. In the next stage of awareness, he realizes the great marvel of marvels, that the essential nature of his being is divine. He then follows the path of upward travel toward divinity. Without realizing his divinity, a human being can be successful in the external world, but can never have a tranquil mind, and he is thus unable to catch a glimpse of the eternal. He longs to be happy, but that dream is not fulfilled. The divine nature in the human being is the sattvic quality of equilibrium, which gives one freedom from the influences of the pairs of opposites. Equilibrium is a state of mind attained by human effort. The aspirant who understands the three qualities of the human mind always remains vigilant and increases his awareness of sattva. One of the qualities of sattva is expansion. Thus the mind, speech, and action of the sattvic aspirant follows the law of expansion and not of contraction. Contraction leads one to feel separate and small, whereas expansion leads one to realize that the self of all is his very essence. Animals are totally dependent on the laws of nature, but human beings can cross the boundaries of natural law by attaining altered states of consciousness. The human being is independent in many ways. He has the ability to fathom the laws of nature by which animals live, and to use those laws for his own ends. The human being alone has enormous capacity to study the various levels of life that have evolved in the universe. He is divine, human, and animal all at the same time, and his behavior depends on which part of him is most developed. Through direct experience, sages acquire the essential knowledge of the Vedas. They go to the source from which the Vedic knowledge springs. With inward sadhana, they reach the highest summit from which they can have profound knowledge of all levels of life and the universe. They find ever-flowing knowledge within and without. One who is thirsty drinks water, but one who has quenched his thirst has no need to stoop down to fetch water from streams and wells. Thus the sage who has become one with truth has no need for the incomplete and limited knowledge expressed through words and concepts. Verse 47.
Karmanyevadikaraste ma phaleshu kadachana ma karma phalahetur bhur ma te sangostva karmani.
You are entitled only to actions and never to fruits. Do not consider yourself to be a cause of the fruits of actions, nor let your attachment be to inaction. After one has attained profound knowledge of all levels of life, what is the surest way to apply that knowledge so that life becomes meaningful and fulfilling? Sri Krishna advises Arjuna to become aware of that which is his and that which is not his. He explains that one has the right to perform his duty, but he has no right to expect the fruits received therein. Neither duty performed with the motivation to acquire the fruits of one's actions, nor attachment towards inaction, is helpful. Both tendencies are harmful. If the law of karma is not properly understood, one becomes helpless and inactive, or he performs his actions with attachment to the results and thus becomes disappointed. Disappointment is a great enemy of self-reliance. It obstructs the faculty of discrimination, judgment, and decisiveness, the guiding factors within us. There are two main principles to be followed when doing one's actions. One should not act impulsively, but should counsel within before acting, and one should not perform any action motivated by selfishness. Right action is superior to inaction. Inaction makes one lethargic, and one who becomes lethargic postpones his duties and joys, placing them in the hands of his fate and future. Students are always warned by their teachers not to become victims of sloth and inactivity, for human beings cannot live without thinking and acting. Because of the lack of real guidance, some people today take drugs. If one takes drugs, he cannot practice sadhana and make his mind one-pointed and inward. The use of drugs leads to inactivity and then to inertia, and one's acts are then prompted by the motivation of tamas. A tamasic person deludes himself. He thinks that he already knows everything, that he has no need to learn and to transform himself, and that he therefore does not have to do his sadhana. He should understand that it is the tamasic quality of mind that disturbs his motivation for sadhana. Motivation needs proper organization with the help of steady sadhana and the guidance of a competent preceptor. Motivation is action in a subtle form. It is what motivates one that is important, because one's motivation is responsible for molding his thought patterns and for prompting him to do actions. It is a guiding force which if properly used can make one victorious in the external world as well as in the unfoldment of his inner potentials. There are two kinds of motivation. One prompts the aspirant to perform actions in the external world, and the other helps him to make his mind one-pointed and inward. The motivation that prompts one to perform action with a desire for reward is predominant in the animal kingdom. So reward and punishment are two methods applied in training animals. The human being, though a higher species, is also motivated by reward and punishment. Yet he can go beyond that. Sri Krishna advises Arjuna to go beyond all expectations, for expectation is the cause of despair and disappointment. The human being alone has the gift of judgment, discrimination, and decision. Every action has its consequent effect, and the fruition of the action is ordinarily perceived as either a reward or a punishment. But one can choose to make a loving offering of the fruits of his actions for the benefit of others. Then one performs his actions skillfully, selflessly, and lovingly, offering the fruits of his actions for the sake of humanity. Thus he is constantly praying. Such prayer is actual prayer. It is not at all like the prayer of egotistical people. Most people are motivated to do actions for the sake of receiving rewards. Attachment to rewards is a deep-rooted habit. Most people do not understand how to be selfless. Such human beings are rajasic. Reward-oriented people are very selfish. They suffer, and they make others suffer. Perhaps that is one reason that the best of men have retreated to forest dwellings, wondering, why do human beings still behave like animals? After intensive self-study, those great ones devised practical methods for transforming humanity, and they gave us their wisdom through the scriptures. Suffering comes when one is interested in reward. If one performs actions expecting rewards, he is bound to receive the fruits of his actions. The fruits then motivate him to do more actions. And in this way, he finds himself caught in the whirlpool of life, never content, always seeking more and more for himself, and ignoring or using others for his own gain. Actions done for reward thus create bondage. One becomes a slave to rewards in much the same way that the rat in scientific experiments becomes a slave to the pellet box, performing only those actions that bring him a token reinforcement. But there is a way to attain release from such enslavement. Perform your duties skillfully and selflessly without attachment to reward. Then you will be free, a mukta, traveling and singing the songs of joy without cares or fears. Verse 48.
Yogastha kuru karmani sangam tyaktva dhananjaya siddhya siddhyo samo bhutva samatvam yoga uchyate.
Perform actions dwelling in yoga, abandoning attachment, O conqueror of wealth, being alike to success and failure. Equanimity is called yoga. Verse 48 further explains the way to do one's actions without creating conflict and suffering for oneself and for others. One should maintain equanimity within and harmony between himself and others. Evenness and tranquility are based on constant awareness of one's essential nature, which is Satyam, Shivam, Sundaram, truth, happiness, and bliss. Unless one understands the fleeting nature of the pairs of opposites, pain and pleasure, sorrow and joy, through the help of profound and systematic sadhana, he cannot go beyond those experiences to attain a state of inner peace. According to Patanjali, the codifier of yoga science, the practical methods that are applied to attain perfect control of the mind and its modifications are called yoga. The yogi who has control of the mind and its modifications maintains balance of mind and inner composure in all situations and under all conditions. Those who do not have control of their minds are lost, for they remain enslaved by the external environment and their reactions to it. Modern man does not yet understand the importance and necessity of controlling the mind. He thinks that it is impossible to understand anything that cannot be seen with the eyes and touched by the fingers. It has already been said that such an attitude is the cause of much human misery and the source of innumerable psychosomatic diseases. If modern man learns to do some practices that will enable him to understand his internal states and to organize them in an orderly way, he will free himself from a great deal of misery and suffering. He will be able to eliminate mental and emotional turmoil, as well as psychosomatic illnesses. One often hears complaints from so-called rich and well-off people that life is burdensome. The rich man says, "We have all the comforts and amenities of life, but not peace of mind." Unless one understands life within as well as without, and learns to create a bridge between these two aspects of life, he will never find peace of mind, no matter how much wealth he possesses. Why do we not learn to spend some time doing practices that will help us analyze and control our thoughts, emotions, desires, and appetites? Those who live in the contemporary world often say that they are not happy in their present situations, yet they feel compelled to live under the circumstances in which they find themselves. But what are those circumstances, and who created them? If one analyzes his circumstances, he will find that they are actually self-created. The predicaments one experiences are a result of his disorderly mind, which does not know how to adjust itself to the various relationships that he has created for himself. Verily, all miseries are self-created. One should not blame God for one's own incompetencies, but modern man feels delight in blaming others for his own failures. That is merely an escape, and only provides temporary relief through an emotional outburst. Such escape does not work for a long time, for the reality within eventually compels one to face the facts of life. Throughout the East and West, individuals and groups suffering from this self-delusion blame others or God for the situations they themselves create. People have to perform their duties, and yet they do not like to perform them. This creates serious conflict and is one of the chief causes of modern illnesses. When one experiences repeated conflict between his duties and his desires, various forms of neurotic disorders and psychosomatic disturbances result. One who performs his duties grudgingly experiences no happiness in life, or one may run away from his duties and lead an undisciplined life of self-interest. Many people remain torn by conflict or plagued by guilt because they have avoided their duties. Then they experience anxiety, or the anxiety is expressed in physical symptoms. Modern psychologists are making futile efforts to probe into the heart of these disorders, and they have not as yet found adequate methods to resolve them. Their results are often long in coming and incomplete. The Bhagavad Gita, however, offers a profound method for removing all such disorders by leading one to a state of inner composure from which he can perform actions skillfully and without negative repercussions for himself or others. To attain this way of being, one must transform himself through sadhana. Harmonious action in the world will follow later. Without sadhana, peaceful living is not possible. In order to achieve successful outcomes from the actions he performs, one must have a well-balanced mind. When the aspirant understands the importance of equanimity of mind, he pays attention to his inner organization and becomes aware of those finer forces that normally remain in a dormant state. Anything that is within is easily accessible if one follows a definite path of sadhana. Regardless of which path one follows, if he follows it resolutely and steadily, he will attain a balanced state of mind, and thus will not commit errors when performing his duties. When one learns to enjoy the beauty and grandeur of non-attachment, he acquires the ability to love his duties, and comes to experience the offering of the fruits of his actions as the highest of all joys. Non-attachment becomes a great delight and the love of his life. Love and non-attachment are synonymous. One may erroneously believe that non-attachment leads to inaction and indifference. On the contrary, When one learns to do his duty with non-attachment, he is performing his dharma with love. Such a yogi need not seek salvation elsewhere, for he is already a mukta, a free man. He lives in the world, yet is free from it. One who has learned to surrender all the fruits of his actions in the service of humanity is constantly praying. He does not create obstacles for himself. How ironic that most human beings create obstacles for themselves and then make efforts to remove them. Is that an enlightened way of living? Many students today waste their time and energy in that sort of folly. Although they work hard, they do not attain anything. The true sadhaka, however, always remains vigilant and does not slip back to his past habits. Instead, he attains the next level of consciousness. The yogi should understand two symbols. The lotus, which grows in water, though its petals remain untouched by the water, and the sun, which shines eternally and equally for all, yet remains above and far away, unaffected by the changes occurring in the world. These are symbols of the yoga of equanimity, which leads one to perfection. Verses 49 through 51.
Durena hyavaram karma buddhi yogat dhananjaya buddhau sharanam anvicha krupana phalahetavah buddhi yukto jahatiha ubhe sukruta duskrute tasmad yogaya yujyasva yoga karmasu kaushalam karmajam buddhi yuktahi phalam tyaktva manishinah janma bandha vinirmukta padam gacchantyanamayam.
Action is by far lower than the yoga of wisdom, O Arjuna. Seek to take refuge in wisdom. Those whose actions are causes of fruits are petty-minded. One endowed with wisdom relinquishes here both the good deeds as well as the bad ones. Therefore, be directed toward yoga. Yoga is skillfulness in actions. The wise men endowed with wisdom indeed give up the fruit that arises from action. Liberated from the bondage of birth and its attendant cycles, they reach the state of wellness and holiness. After describing the negative effects of working for rewards, Sri Krishna explains the importance of performing disciplined action with non-attachment. The term buddhi yoga refers to action performed with a mental attitude of non-attachment to the fruits of one's action. Buddhi has the ability to discriminate between the real self and the non-self, and with such discrimination one can develop non-attachment to the non-self. A person with a dissipated mind is unable to comprehend the limitless joy that is experienced by the aspirant who is tranquil, performing his duties selflessly and skillfully. But when the mind is tranquil, pure reason, buddhi, is able to function. A tranquil mind alone has the capacity to maintain inner poise, which inspires and leads one to perform action skillfully and without attachment to the results. Such actions become a means for fulfilling the purpose of life, whereas actions performed with selfish desire bind one to the objects of the world. Actions done with non-attachment lead to complete freedom. A disciplined mind and non-attachment are two important requisites for performing skillful action. If these qualities are absent, the mind is continually tossed by preoccupation with gain and loss, success and failure. Such a disturbed and distracted mind is not helpful at all. Instead, it is repeatedly a source of disappointment and can create misery, grief, and sorrow. Skilled action is the gift of a disciplined mind, and non-attachment is the gift of buddhi yoga, the yoga of pure reason. Skilled and disciplined action and non-attachment are separated here only to enable one to understand the importance of developing both. But actually, the two qualities go hand in hand. Disciplined action is definitely superior to inept and harmful action. This is clear when we examine the fruits of each. Although disciplined action brings positive results, one is still not free because those results prompt him to do more actions. It is not possible through disciplined action alone for one to come out of the whirlpool created by his actions and the fruits he receives from those actions. Only when disciplined action is combined with non-attachment is one free from the bondage of his actions. The deeds performed by one who has a tranquil mind are totally different from those performed by selfish people who desire to enjoy the fruits arising from their deeds. When the thought of dedicating and surrendering the fruits of one's action is predominant in one's mind, he is indeed selfless. A selfless person is concerned with the needs of others. His focus is on giving rather than on receiving. The family institution helps one to understand the philosophy of giving. When a man learns to give to his wife, children, and other family members, he is taking the first step in learning to give. He can expand that awareness to his neighbor, nation, the whole of humanity, and to all creatures of the world. Learning to love others is one side of a coin. The other side is life itself. Without love, life is impossible, and without life, love is impossible. Love and life are two sides of the same whole. They are inseparable. Nay, they are one and the same. In modern life, instead of learning to give, everyone in the family expects to receive without giving. Whereas giving is an expression of selflessness, expectation is an expression of selfishness. A selfish husband and father uses his wife and children to satisfy his ego. He does not know the law of giving. When this way of being is typical, the family institution radiates hatred instead of radiating love, and chaos is created in society. When one has expectations, he is never fulfilled. But giving is a fulfillment in itself. The truth that every action has a reaction is acknowledged equally by philosophers and scientists. Expectation rebounds on the human being, and so does love. When one has expectations, the result is dissatisfaction, disappointment, distress, sorrow, and pain. But when one gives, there is a feeling of satisfaction and contentment through and through. The reaction received from giving is fulfillment. The wise person gives for another reason as well. He knows that the expectation of receiving rewards brings those rewards, and then he will become caught in the whirlpool of attachment and bondage to those rewards. That leads to a kind of suicide, for one becomes smothered by his accumulated possessions. The Upanishads say, "Enjoy through renunciation, for that is the way of salvation." But the question arises, how is it possible for one to live in the world and to discharge his duties without becoming attached to the objects of the world? The Bhagavad Gita explains that this can be accomplished by developing the understanding that all things of the world, animate and inanimate, are not ours. We have the right to use and enjoy them, but not the right to possess them. This teaching is like a ray of light that tears the veil of false identity and possessiveness, which always creates misery. One should have an exact, profound, and comprehensive attitude toward life. He should understand the law of action and reaction and the importance of giving up possessions. Otherwise, the joy of giving and loving is changed into sorrow and misery. But instead of understanding this fact, modern man becomes overwhelmed by the sense of ownership. And when one possesses something that does not really belong to him, he lives as a thief and not as a free man. Intellectuals raise the question, if one does not desire the fruits of action, will he be motivated to act? In response to this question, the sages who have trodden the path and graciously left their footprints for us to follow, have said again and again, have a desire so that you perform the action, but do not have a selfish desire, for selfish desire is the very source of misery, but selfless desire brings joy and makes you free. When surrendering the fruits of actions becomes the basis of one's life, he knows nothing but giving. And at that stage, further knowledge is not needed, for one has already attained the goal of life. He realizes his oneness with all and lives in that realization. Therefore, give up all the fruits of your actions to others and live in perennial happiness. Verses 52 and 53.
Yadate moha kalilam buddhir vyatitarishyati tada gantasi nirvedam shrotavyasya shrutasyacha. Shrutivipratipannate yada sthasyati nishchala samadha vachala buddhihi tada yogam avapsyasi.
When your intellect overcomes and crosses the confused mass of delusion, then you will reach the state of dispassion concerning all that you have heard and learned and all that you have yet to hear and learn. When your intellect, previously confused by the variety of teachings, remains firm and unmoving in samadhi, then you will attain yoga. These verses explain the evolving state of buddhi. When buddhi soars high, tearing the veils of delusion, one rises above all intellectual pursuits. The teachings that may be encountered from outside are already accessible through buddhi and are fully grasped. All knowledge is known to such a one, and he attains the highest state of yoga. When buddhi is fully developed, one has freedom from the mire of delusion, for he has unalloyed knowledge. Pure buddhi is able to unfold all the secrets of the universe, and all the feebleness and conflicts of the mind are resolved. The lower mind, manas, is that part of the mind which functions by employing the senses to receive knowledge from the external world and employing the organs of action to act upon the external world. All sense perceptions are filtered in a system of conceptualization. A disorganized and uncontrolled mind does not have exact perceptions, and thus cannot conceptualize or act accurately. A clouded mind that receives its information through untrained senses forms distorted concepts and remains deluded. But the mind that learns to consult and seek the counsel of buddhi and forms the habit of not initiating action without a decision from buddhi is a well-controlled mind, and it can conceptualize and act in a useful, efficient, and harmonious way. When the lower mind, with the help of sadhana, constantly listens to buddhi with one-pointedness, there is no danger of committing errors. There are two different states of buddhi, lower buddhi and higher buddhi. The lower buddhi gives diverse instructions one after another, but with its pure reason, the higher buddhi gives firm instruction for the benefit of the whole being. It is aware of the source of consciousness within and at the same time has discriminatory knowledge of the external world. All the great spiritual leaders like Buddha, Krishna, Jesus, and Moses acted with the help of pure reason, which is called higher buddhi. Pure reason, or higher buddhi, is completely sattvic, without any tinge of rajas or tamas. Those who have complete mastery over their internal states acquire the gift of pure reason, and then no one in any circumstances can ever change the course of their actions. Socrates, even while drinking the goblet of hemlock, did not alter his convictions. Jesus on the cross did not say, "Forgive me, don't crucify me." With the help of the same pure reason and firm faith, Moses asked the sea to part and create a path. Pure reason, firm faith, and willpower function together and make a great force that can perform all manner of wonders. In such a state, all the functions of mind work in a unified way, and there is no doubt at all. According to Eastern psychology, the ego, or sense of I-ness, is like a rock without buddhi. It is dumb and deaf. But Western psychologists attribute all the qualities of buddhi to the ego because they do not have the comprehensive knowledge of the various faculties of mind. Their way of analysis involves knowing through the intellect, logic, and external observation, whereas the perennial psychology of the East has differentiated various functions of the mind with the help of discipline and the introspective method of inner sadhana. This method is based on direct inward knowledge, whereas the methods of modern psychologists rely on the collection of data from external observation. Western psychologists have begun to realize that the study of the waking state alone is not sufficient, and they are now probing into one level of the unconscious, the dream state. But there are other subtle dimensions of life that are part of the unconscious that are not explored by modern psychology. Modern psychologists do not understand that which is beyond observation and the analysis of thoughts and emotions. According to Eastern psychology, there are subtle dimensions of life still to be explored by the West. Suppose a mosquito bites someone who is in deep sleep. His fingers reach for the bite, yet he is not aware of it. What is that level of life that remains awake recording such occurrences even during the sleeping state? The perennial psychology of the East has answers to these questions. According to that psychology, it is not the mind that goes through the waking, dreaming, and sleeping states. The mind shares the experiences, but it is actually the individual self, jiva, which is quite different from the ego, that experiences the waking, dreaming, and sleeping states. The individual self presents a personality of its own, for it uses a particular vehicle called the unconscious, which is the reservoir of all the past impressions of the mind, action, and speech. As long as the self uses the unconscious as a vehicle, it is called jiva. But the moment the self renounces the vehicle, it is called pure consciousness. As long as the intellect is clouded, one remains selfish, and as long as he remains selfish, the mind is impure. One then depends on others and loses self-reliance. He collects pleasurable objects and remains deluded and allured by the temptations of the external world. His troubles increase day by day, and sunk in immense sorrow, he struggles for peace. In the course of seeking truth, he may meet a sadhaka or spiritual guide. Then alone does he think of coming out of the mire of delusion created by his selfishness. He begins to cast off his infatuations and to seek practical methods of ridding himself of the impurities of the mind and intellect. Scriptural knowledge has its importance, for it inspires the aspirant on the path of sadhana. The scriptures constantly remind the sadhaka of the goal of his life. But how did these scriptures come into existence? And why are they accepted as testimony in guiding sadhakas? Shveta Upanishad says that the great sages, in deep contemplation and in the highest state of tranquility, came in touch with the supernatural power and thus experienced the profound knowledge and wisdom of the timeless and infinite eternal truth. If the sadhaka systematically practices fathoming all the levels of life and goes to the source from which the wisdom of the Veda flows, he will experience the direct knowledge that is higher than the knowledge received by hearing the Vedic scriptures and their interpretations. The knowledge attained through sadhana is higher than any other source of knowledge. There are three accepted methods of attaining this wisdom, and there are three aspects of one's being that need to be controlled and disciplined. Numerous paths are described in various traditions, but among these paths, prayer, meditation, and contemplation have been universally accepted and verified by the ancients. Discipline of mind, action, and speech are auxiliary, preliminary, and essential steps in each of these three different approaches. Let us explain and understand each of these distinct approaches separately. Prayer purifies the way of the soul. It is a means to expand one's consciousness within. It is not a mere petition, but it makes the mind aware of the dimensions of life that is the very source of one's being. Prayer has immense power and can lead one to the highest state of ecstasy. It is the way of using emotional power by awakening, evoking, and transforming it. History reveals that constant prayer can transform human beings. There is no doubt that if prayer is properly practiced, positive results are imminent. There are two types of prayer. The inferior type of prayer is egocentric prayer. It is used by the selfish person who merely desires to fulfill his wants. I remains the center of such prayer. O Lord, give me this. Do this for me. Help me to have this object. This sort of prayer, full of wants, is used to justify one's selfish ends. Though it works, it does not lead one to nearness to the absolute. Such prayer, regularly conducted in all great religions, reduces the magnanimity of prayer to a selfish petition, It does not lead one to go beyond the mire of delusion created by the ego. When the aspirant understands that possession of the mundane objects of the world for which selfish people pray does not make one happy, he realizes that egocentric prayers have limited effects with limited gains. He begins thinking, I am committing a mistake somewhere. Either my method of prayer is incomplete, or my motives are not right. Egocentric prayer is thus discarded by the true aspirant, and then he seeks the higher way of prayer, God-centered prayer. God-centered prayer gives immense joy to the human mind. Those who practice this approach believe that God is a being who has full power to fulfill the desires of human beings. Overwhelmed with this idea, they pray to God to give them strength, wisdom, and skill so that they can discharge their duties efficiently and at the same time understand the meaning of life. In God-centered prayer, one does not leave all the human responsibilities to God with the expectation that God will take care of those responsibilities, but one prays to God to give him strength so that he can understand and fulfill his duties and serve others selflessly. This type of prayer expands one's consciousness, whereas ego-centered prayer envelops one with selfish words and makes one small, petty-minded, greedy, and inconsiderate. The Lord's Prayer is an example of God-centered prayer. It is a glorification of God and has no selfish motivation. It is like a stream crying to meet the ocean. In God-centered prayer, the individual accepts God in his life as a guide, leader, and judge of his actions and speech. Prayer is very useful, but at the same time, it advocates and promotes the philosophy of dualism, which asserts that man and God remain forever distinct. The individual always remains an individual, and there is no union with God, only a nearness to God. Dualism is an acceptance of two separate existences. There has been a great deal of debate by scholars about whether dualism is a valid philosophy. The validity of the dualistic approach is not a matter to be debated. Dualism should be understood as a stage of sadhana that provides a path that can eventually lead to the higher realm of knowledge, that of complete unity. It is valid as a preliminary stage of sadhana, as an experience on the way to the realization of the Absolute. The next approach is deeper, more profound and systematic, and is suitable to explorers and yogis. It is called meditation. Meditation is an inward method in which a systematic study is conducted to gain knowledge of the Absolute. It goes beyond prayer to help one realize the higher dimensions of life. In this approach, it is believed that the human being is a dweller in two worlds, the world within himself and the world outside. One develops profound self-mastery so that he is able to go to the source of consciousness through a meditative method and to simultaneously develop the ability to perform his duties skillfully, selflessly, and lovingly. Meditation thus has two aspects, meditation in silence and meditation in action. The Bhagavad Gita teaches both. Many scholars, however, do not know how to practice meditation and do not understand how the meditative mind can be capable of performing skillful actions. But Karma Yoga, the yoga of action, and Dhyana Yoga, the yoga of meditation, cannot be separated. One who has the ability and capacity to meditate in silence also has the capacity to perform his duties skillfully. Sincerity, truthfulness, and purity of heart are prerequisites for the method of prayer. But in meditation, stillness, even breathing, withdrawal of the senses, calming down the conscious mind, going beyond the unconscious, and finally attaining the state of tranquility or samadhi are the systematic steps one has to follow. Many incomplete methods are practiced these days, and according to their advocates, these methods are the only way. Such claims by bogus teachers are laughable. Meditation, as taught by Patanjali's method, is a systematic approach, like climbing a ladder and finally reaching the highest rung, the state of samadhi. It is not at all religious, and to give it religious color, as some mistakenly do, is to vulgarize a purely scientific and methodical way of attaining samadhi, a state in which all of one's questions are resolved. Samadhi is the goal of the meditator. In that supreme state, which bestows serenity in all conditions, the individual unites himself with the self-existent reality. There are no shortcuts, such as those taught by many modern teachers. Meditation is a discipline that must be resolutely practiced if one is to be transported from the physical to the subtlest aspect of his being, and finally, to that fountainhead of life and light where the purest consciousness perennially resides in all its glory. Marvelous results can be observed when the method of meditation is introduced gradually, step by step. Meditational therapy is the highest of all therapies, providing that the therapist is competent and knows how to apply this form of therapy systematically. All other methods of therapy offer only momentary relief, and often one becomes dependent on the therapist. In meditational therapy, however, the student is led towards self-reliance, self-examination, self-verification, self-analysis, and self-attainment. Modern students often ask the question, how many days, months, or years must we train ourselves? That depends upon the aspirant's sincerity, determination, and one-pointedness of mind, and on how regularly he practices. The Bhagavad Gita teaches meditation in action, meditation in life, and Arjuna learns this method and becomes enlightened. The teachings of the Bhagavad Gita last for only 18 days, and these 18 days of teaching encompass the entire knowledge that one needs in order to have a comprehensive knowledge of Atman, the Self, which is the Self of all. In meditation itself, the time factor is annihilated, because meditation is a state of mind beyond the prime conditionings of time, space, and causation. Ordinarily, the student should first learn to rid himself of his old habits and the stains of the samskaras and impressions of his past deeds, which create a setback in his inward journey. The time factor totally depends on the individual. If the student is like Arjuna, and if his teacher is like Sri Krishna, enlightenment will come very fast. But if he does not meditate and follow the other practices regularly with full determination, progress can be very slow. The third approach, that of contemplation, is practiced by a fortunate few. To perform skillful action with non-attachment, one must sharpen his faculty of discrimination, judgment, and decisiveness. Knowledge flows from within, and the external world is the field of expression of that knowledge through various avenues that are available to us, mainly mind, action, and speech. Contemplation is not an unorganized way of thinking. It is a precise method. For contemplation, one must train buddhi in all its aspects. A trained buddhi has pure reason, and pure reason has immense power to lead the aspirant to the door of liberation. First, the student listens to the scriptures and studies them under the guidance of a competent teacher, an enlightened one who has gained direct knowledge and who is able to understand the subtleties of the teachings of the great ones. Then, like a humming bee, with great joy he collects fragrances from different flowers and converts them into honey. The first step is called sravana. The second is called manana. Then one attains the third step, called nididhyasa, which means assimilating the knowledge one has gained and living according to it. After attaining that step, sakshatkara, in which the knowledge of the whole is revealed, occurs. We have described three approaches in brief. Now we will explain the importance of discipline, without which one cannot be successful in any of these approaches. Discipline should be practiced on three levels: mind, action, and speech. The human being knows everything that he ought to know about how to live in the world and how to relate to others. He has been taught, for example, the importance of being kind and gentle, but one does not know how to put these principles into practice. The emphasis of this commentary is therefore on practice. As our Gurudeva used to say, do not waste your time thinking and planning to follow the path. Decide and just follow. Spiritual sadhana requires the discipline of mind, action, and speech. Even preliminary discipline of mind, action, and speech can lead one to the experience of supernatural phenomena not ordinarily experienced by students who collect information but do not practice. Sometimes the great swamis, sages, and yogis who have practiced discipline speak with profound clarity, and whatever they say happens exactly as they said it would. They do not care to debate about what truth is. They simply say that when one practices non-lying, he speaks the truth. We have recorded many instances in which a sage has said something that seems impossible, yet it happens just as he said. By following sanyama, discipline, one can perform such miracles. A miracle is a miracle only as long as one does not know how it came about. The moment that is known, it is no longer a miracle. If one wastes his power of speech, indulging in useless discussions, talking nonsense, lying intentionally, hurting others through his speech, condemning others, or speaking against others' religion, vak shakti, the power of words, does not find effective expression through his speech. But if one conserves his power of speech and does not lie, his speech can become so powerful that whatever he says will come to pass. If one also disciplines his actions by not doing what is not to be done, he will find that he is doing his actions more efficiently and more accurately than before. The question may arise, how can one know what is not right? The answer is that one's conscience already knows what is right and wrong, good and bad, helpful and unhelpful. One simply has to tune into his inner conscience, which guides him all the time. That is called seeking counsel within before performing action. It has already been explained that one already knows. He simply has to practice. In the course of practicing not doing that which is not to be done, one will find that he is being guided from within. Then he can learn to develop a dialogue with his conscience, which is not polluted by the fickleness and feebleness of the mind. Experimenting in this way leads one to understand that the real counselor is within each person. The first and foremost duty of a true and selfless teacher is to introduce his student to that inner guide, which leads one during the waking, dreaming, and sleeping states. When one takes a few moments from his busy life and learns to sit calmly in a quiet place, the inner counselor begins counseling. It would be helpful if modern therapists and psychologists, as well as priests and spiritual teachers, would learn to listen to the inner counselor and then introduce that inner guide to their clients and students. After practicing disciplined action and speech and studying their marvelous effects, one should learn to understand and practice mental discipline. When one does not allow his mind to think that which is negative and which makes him depressed and sad, his mind begins forming new habits of joy. Slowly, he begins discriminating between helpful thoughts and those unhelpful thoughts that consume more human energy than anything else. This introspective, inspecting within, method leads one to the next step, witnessing. Here, one learns to witness all that happens, both in the external and internal worlds, without becoming involved in it. While one is still learning, he must be patient and not become disappointed if at times he fails to remain a witness, but instead becomes emotionally caught up in what is taking place. In pursuing such a self-training program, one should make a commitment to himself for the sake of his growth that he will practice regularly and faithfully, no matter what. This is not the same as following a commandment or a blind injunction. Many people are afraid to make commitments because they believe that by not making commitments, they will be free. But lack of commitment is merely irresponsibility and does not bring about true freedom. When one is afraid to make a commitment, it is because he is fearful of accepting responsibility. But real freedom is attained only when one is no longer a slave of his emotions and mental life. To be responsible is to be strong. With the help of mental discipline, one's internal organization can be arranged in a way that prevents emotional disturbances and physical maladies. After understanding the importance of the discipline of mind, speech, and action, and after practicing that discipline regularly for some time, one experiences certain extraordinary phenomena that are based on those realities that cannot be understood by the conscious mind. In each approach, whether it be prayer, meditation, or contemplation, discipline plays a role, like that of a father who protects his loving child with his tender arms and loving teachings. Verse 54.
Arjuna Vacha. Stita prajnyasya ka bhasha samadhisthasya keshava? Stitadi kim prabhasheta kim asita rajeta kim?
Arjuna said, "What is the description of a person of steady insight who remains in samadhi, O Krishna? How does a person of stable wisdom speak forth? How does he sit? How does he walk?" The path of equanimity does not promise that one will attain godhood, but it will lead him to attain a state of tranquility, a state of perfection, free of misery and pain. In this verse, the word stitta prajna, steady insight, carries deep meaning. Arjuna asks his revered teacher to describe the man of perfectly poised discernment who has established himself in his essential nature. How does he speak? How does he sit? How does he walk? And how does he carry out his duties? How does one know that a person has attained an equable state of perfection? Arjuna's question carries great meaning and is equally valuable to modern man. He wants to know the definite signs and symptoms that denote that one has attained a state of equanimity. Since all human beings express themselves through speech and actions in much the same manner, how does the behavior of the great man differ from that of the ordinary man? How does the great man express his thoughts, emotions, and desires? How is his mind, action, and speech guided by his inner attainment of tranquility? The ancients developed a behavioral psychology of considerable breadth. They not only studied the motivations of one's behavior, but also the behavioral signs and symptoms of various internal states and the means for modifying behavior. In many cases, signs and symptoms help one to analyze the behavior of a human being, but not in all cases. For example, a person may cry because of intense unhappiness, because he is touched by an expression of love or beauty, or because he identifies with someone who is suffering. Therefore, we cannot know the reason by merely observing the behavior. In order to analyze human behavior, one must also probe into the deeper level from whence all emotions spring. The signs and symptoms of one who has inner balance and poise, the way such a one speaks, acts, and sits, are different from those of a human being who has not disciplined himself and has not attained a state of equanimity. Having a tranquil mind, the man of equanimity sits in a calm, still posture. He walks with full confidence without any fear or uncertainty. He speaks with clarity of mind in a straightforward way. All men can be divided into two categories. There is the man of equanimity and the man of disharmony. The man of equanimity is the ideal man of the Bhagavad Gita. He remains undisturbed, unattached, happy, and joyous in all external circumstances. But the man of disharmony is completely uncoordinated and suffers from lack of discipline and awareness. The majority of individuals in society are of the latter type. They do not practice any self-discipline. Therefore, their behavior is uncoordinated, and for lack of coordination, unity is not attained. We see this confusion all over in the East and West. The highest method of education known so far is self-education and self-training, but without discipline, it is not possible to educate oneself. The Bhagavad Gita, and this verse in particular, is closely related to the Mandukya Upanishad, one of the best and perhaps most thought-provoking books in the library of man today. The Mandukya Upanishad thoroughly explains three states of mind: waking, dreaming, and sleeping. The explanation of these states has been expanded in the Mandukya Karika commentary by Gaudapada, the great grandmaster of Shankara. The man who has attained equanimity can survey each of these three states of human experience at once, while at the same time maintaining his position in the state beyond, called Turiya. Deep sleep is very close to the state of Turiya, but in deep sleep one is not aware, while in Turiya unbroken consciousness exists. The purpose of the teachings of the Bhagavad Gita is to lead Arjuna and all the Arjunas of the world to attain the state of Turiya. That state is the highest that can ever be experienced. One who experiences Turiya is called a man of equanimity. For the ordinary man, waking, dreaming, and sleeping are three different realities, and he is not at all aware of the fourth. However, one who has attained the timeless state of equanimity has gone beyond all conditionings of time, past, present, and future, and for him, everything is here and now. The words here and now are commonly used, but only a few accomplished ones have experiential access to this reality, for it is a part of eternity. When past and future are available to be experienced here and now, one has attained a timeless state and thus has become an inseparable part of infinity. Infinite knowledge then remains at his disposal. Ordinary people experience the reality of the waking, dreaming, and sleeping states separately, but one who has gone beyond and has attained the summit can clearly observe the functionings of consciousness in these three spheres of human experience as a single line that is continuous rather than broken into three parts. For the man of equanimity, the three phases are one and the same conscious and continuous reality, just as morning, noon, and evening are each aspects of a single day. The man of partial and limited knowledge remains in doubt and confusion about the meaning and purpose of his life because he knows only a part and does not have a profound knowledge of the whole. But the great man remains undisturbed and in perfect poise even on the battlefield, for he has discovered the mysteries of both the known and the unknown, the eternal and the non-eternal. Such a warrior is victorious in all times, conditions, and states. The dreaming state is a state of unfulfillment, but that state of mind does have some therapeutic value, for it gives one the opportunity to express all his unfulfilled and suppressed desires. A study of dreams can help one to understand the two lives that we live. One is the conscious life, and the other is that which is forgotten. We think that our forgotten life does not influence our waking life, but that is not true. Dreams are evidence that forgotten, suspended, undealt with, and unfulfilled desires remain sleeping in the unconscious and rise again when there is sufficient reason. The waking state is experienced by a very small part of the mind and is in no way capable of comprehending the meaning of the whole. Our modern methods of education and training are imperfect because they focus only on that small aspect of the totality of our internal organization. Here lies the tragedy and bankruptcy of the modern way of life and education, that which is the cause of misery in the world today. Why haven't we devised inner methods and made them available for all, so that everyone has access to all the states of one's being? Such education was available in ancient times, but it has been largely forgotten today. Modern therapists and psychologists have started probing into the dreaming state, but their exploration is still in an infant stage and needs different methods. They do not have a practical training program to explore the many aspects of the unconscious mind. The Bhagavad Gita, however, offers the knowledge that can help the modern therapist to know the unknown dimensions of life. Arjuna's questions show that he has come out of his state of despondency. He now intently follows Sri Krishna's teachings and is eager to know more about the state of inner discrimination. Sri Krishna has led Arjuna from the most despondent state of consciousness to the state of balance and inner poise. By analyzing Arjuna's thoughts, actions, and speech, one can clearly understand the differences between these two states. In his former state, Arjuna was ignorant, depressed, weak, and full of fear and anxiety. But his questions show that he is now on the path of wisdom and in the process of self-transformation. He is an entirely different person. When one practices sadhana, a transformation takes place, and the thoughts and behavior of the aspirant change drastically. The power of self-transformation is our most important human resource. If the individual can be transformed, the whole of humanity can be transformed. Will there be a day when human society makes good use of this self-transformation process? That will be possible when the educational system includes those methods of self-discipline by which one can attain the free spirit of the man of equanimity. Verses 55 through 57.
Shri Bhagavan Uvacha. Prajahati yada kaman sarvan partha manogatan atmanyevatmana tushtah sthita prajnyastadochyate. Dukkesh anudvignamanah sukhesh vigataspruhah vitaraga bhayak krodah sthitadir muniruchyate. Yas sarvatran abhisnehas tattat prapya shubhashubham nabhi nandati nadveshti tasya prajna pratishthita.
The Blessed Lord said, when one entirely abandons all the desires that come into the mind, O son of Pritha, satisfied within the self by the self, then he is called a person of stable wisdom. One whose mind is not agitated in sorrows, who has no attraction toward pleasures, he from whom attraction, fear, and anger have disappeared, such a meditator is called a person of stable wisdom. He who has no attachment directed toward anything, or upon attaining anything good or bad, who neither greets it nor hates it, his wisdom is established. When the aspirant realizes that the external world is but a reflection of the ultimate reality, and that, although the reflection appears to be real, it is not actually so, the objects of the world lose their value for him. He thus experiences the first important step of freedom in the journey to the timeless infinity. Such a one, following the way of inward experiences, finally attains contentment, for he knows the self. The self is known by the self, and not through any other means. When one makes practical use of this knowledge, he attains a state of non-attachment and is no longer bound by likes, dislikes, hatred, or lust. Then one is free from all emotions, desires, and appetites, and this freedom is very valuable in the path to perfection. There is no power that can take this awareness away from him. Only a skilled and disciplined aspirant can understand the expressions, ideas, speech, and actions of the realized one who has attained the state of equanimity. The first and foremost sign one notices in such a person is the tranquility of his mind, which is totally without desire. Such a person is an example to others. He lives as though he were in a glass house from which he can see everyone, and everyone can see him. That way of living and being is attained through a gradual sadhana, in which the aspirant first learns to choose helpful thoughts, emotions, and desires, and to abandon those that are not helpful. In the next stage, he learns to abandon both good and bad, and to witness all of the happenings in the external world, whether they spring from nature or from human society. Desires have their origin in the primitive fountains of food, sex, sleep, and self-preservation. When one learns to regulate those primitive fountains, desires lose their power over him, and he is no longer a slave, but a master. Many naive students think that the worldly objects one possesses must be surrendered or abandoned, but the implication here is entirely different. Surrender has nothing to do with the objects of the world, but with the desires that create limitations and conditionings of the mind. The play of desires exists only in the waking and dreaming states. Desires remain dormant in the state of deep sleep, but one is not conscious in that state. When one is in samadhi, however, he is beyond the states of waking, dreaming, and deep sleep, and remains in a perfect state of consciousness in which desires are completely absent. The consciousness of samadhi is not at all like the consciousness of the waking state, which is just a fragment of the totality of consciousness. The consciousness of samadhi is as wide as infinite space. It is all-inclusive and is an unlimited and perennial source of knowledge. The three lower states, waking, dreaming, and sleeping, are experienced by all creatures, but the fourth state, the highest state of equilibrium, is attained only by the true aspirant. Verse 58.
Yada samharate chayam kurmonga niva sarvashah indriyan indriyarthe vyastasya prajna pratishtita.
When, like a tortoise withdrawing his limbs, one withdraws each and all of the senses from their objects, his wisdom is established. When one gives up his desires, a new horizon of awareness opens to him, but those who hold on to their desires are not able to experience the higher dimensions of life. Fulfilling desires gives birth to many more desires, and there is no end to that cycle. When one learns to give up desires, however, he is elevated to the next step of experience. There is a mental law that if you give up what you have, you receive something new. That principle sustains life. If we do not give up the carbon dioxide and used-up gas by exhaling, we cannot survive at all. We must exhale in order to inhale. In order to survive and to receive, we have to give up. Give up first. Only then will you receive. This law continues to help one until the last breath of life. The student is always afraid and hesitant about giving up, for he is attached to all of the things that he thinks belong to him. His false sense of possessiveness is a great enemy on the path of unfoldment. One must learn to have courage and give up what he has in order to receive that which is glorious and beautiful, limitless and infinite. One of the most important things to be given up is attachment to sensory experience. Withdrawal of the mind from the senses, pratyahara, is given a great deal of importance in the path of meditation, but no book specifically describes this process. Students think it is something that will make them passive, but that is incorrect. It is a skill to have complete control and command over the senses, which are employed by the mind to go to the external world and perceive things. The senses create a serious disturbance, for it is their inherent nature to jump from one object to another, compelled by the charms and temptations of the external world. The mind is disturbed and dissipated by such input, and is unable to conceive of things as they are. Furthermore, the perceived objects are a source of distraction and dissipation. They create serious obstacles and obstructions for the sadhaka in his attempts to fathom higher levels of consciousness. Therefore, it is important to withdraw one's senses from the world of objects. This is not withdrawal from the world or from one's duty. It is learning to gather one's scattered energy. Withdrawal of the senses is an essential part of sadhana. There is a very serious problem with a habitual way of perception. The senses have no capacity or ability to know things as they are. They can only have a partial glimpse of an object. That partial view of the object is charming and compelling, and it disorganizes and distorts the human mind. It only gives an inkling of delight and is not able to provide long-lasting joy because the senses have limited powers to know the objects as they are. There are three serious obstacles that interfere with one's ability to have a comprehensive view of the objects of the world. 1. The mind remains clouded. 2. The clouded mind uses incompetent senses to know the objects of the world. 3. The objects of the world change continually. These three problems lead to self-delusion, and one's ignorance regarding the objects of the world is not dispelled. There is an inborn desire in the human mind and heart to know what is real and what is illusory. But ordinarily, the mind does not know how to do that. No matter how much training is given to the senses do not have the capacity to see things as they are. With the desire to experience the whole as it really is, the mind searches for a different approach, one that does not rely on the senses. It is only with pure reason that the mind can know the nature of the objects of the world, for due to their shallow nature, the senses can never peep into the secrets of the unknown side of the objects. No matter how powerful are the instruments used to see the objects as they are, They fail, for they have no power to reveal the true nature of the objects of the world. There is a systematic method that one can apply to purify the mind so that there is clarity in his knowing. One can focus the mind on one single object. It can be concrete or abstract, large or small, so that the mind withdraws itself from the senses. When the mind is voluntarily isolated and under perfect control, it attains one-pointedness. And if that one-pointedness is turned inward, it becomes a useful means on one's inward journey to another way of knowing. The human being is like a miniature world, so by turning inward and examining himself, one can examine the nature of the universe. The natural tendency of the senses is to lead the mind to the objects of the world. The method that we are explaining is a very beneficial and useful voluntary effort that enables one to see, examine, and verify the nature of the objects of the world. And at the same time, it makes one realize that the objects of the world do not hold any quality to charm and tempt the mind, for temptations and charms are created by the false input of the limited senses. The concentrated power of mind has the ability to know without the help of the senses. In the inner world, the mind does not even need the help of the brain. The brain is only a medium for the energy called mind. It is a powerhouse, not the power. It is a distribution center, but not the energy. Many modern physicists do not accept this theory, for they know only one method, applying sophisticated instruments to amplify sensory experiences. When one uses such instruments to study mental functions, they fail, for these instruments can only measure the superficial workings of the brain. Those who follow this method nevertheless contend that the brain is the mind, and that if they can develop the instruments to study the brain's functioning, they will be able to understand the mind. They are like the blind man who holds the tail of an elephant and contends that an elephant is like a snake because its tail feels like one. Modern technology and scientific knowledge are valid as far as the external world is concerned, but there is another exact science that helps one know the unknown dimensions of life. The Sankhya system of philosophy has given birth to yogic science. It is far more advanced and methodical than modern technology and the scientific method that is being used to probe into the microscopic and macroscopic levels of the physical universe. Because of the limited nature of the senses and the foibles of the mind, one builds his own concepts, which offer a distorted picture of the world. The mind is a huge catalog of conceptions, and it uses these to create a philosophy that is neither reliable nor trustworthy. In order to avoid self-delusion, the sadhaka should understand the importance of voluntary withdrawal of the senses, and then he should make the mind one-pointed and turn it inward. There, he will find a higher knowledge that is not contaminated either by the senses or the distracted and dissipated mind. According to yoga philosophy and psychology, the human being goes through two distinct stages in his journey to self-awakening. The first stage is traditionally referred to as evolution. In this process, consciousness travels from its subtlemost aspect through ever more gross aspects of existence, obscuring all awareness of oneself as pure consciousness. Finally, one becomes completely identified with the external world. In the second stage, which is traditionally referred to as involution, one reverses direction. He turns inward and commences a journey in which he rediscovers and experiences ever more subtle aspects of his being, finally coming to realize himself as pure consciousness. Sensory withdrawal is one of the first important steps in the process of involution, a voluntary withdrawal in which the human mind is turned within. The sadhaka goes against the process of evolution, and that is just like going against the currents of a river. One needs to be well equipped for such an undertaking, for his habits and past experiences continually pull the mind outward. A method of concentration must be carefully devised that leads one to a meditative state, and then finally to the source and center of consciousness. The withdrawal of the senses is a step forward in the path of meditation. Without it, the unknown part of life cannot be revealed to the human being. One half is already known, but only the knowledge of the glorious missing half makes one's knowledge complete and perfect. Verses 59 through 61.
Rasavarjam rasopyasya param drishtva nivartate. Yatato hyapi kaunteya purushasya vipaschitah. Indriyani pramathini haranti prasabam manah. Tani sarvani samyamya yukta asita matparaha. Vashehi yasyendriyani tasya pragnya pratishthita.
When this body bearer desists from food, the senses and their attractions turn away, all except for taste. But taste also ceases upon seeing the Supreme One. Even though an intelligent man continues to endeavor, yet the turbulent senses forcibly draw his mind away. Therefore, controlling them all, joined in yoga, one should remain intent upon me. He whose senses are under control, his wisdom is established. It is the inherent nature of the senses to contact the external world. The senses have tremendous power. Only those who know the technique of withdrawing the senses can realize how powerful they are. A little effort is not sufficient to attain withdrawal of the senses. Aspirants often think that by creating distance from the objects of the senses, by not enjoying the objects, the senses can be controlled. But that is not true. Eating food is a sensory experience, and if one does not eat food for some time, the desire to eat becomes more intense, and the mind imagines food in many forms. By depriving the senses from experiencing their objects, the desire for enjoyment can actually increase rather than decrease. By fasting, one cannot get rid of the vasana, desire, to eat. It is only when the aspirant realizes the self and finds delight in it that he becomes free from the temptations and attractions created by the senses. But the aspirant cannot have knowledge of Atman so long as the charms and temptations are in the mind. If one follows the nature of the senses and does not understand that the senses are the source of distraction, his mind will be completely dissipated. The sadhaka must make constant effort. Regular practice is important. Patanjali, the codifier of yoga science, states in the Yoga Sutras 1.14 that the sadhaka should practice for a long time without any break and with full effort and profound faith. Otherwise, sadhana will not be fruitful. Steady-mindedness is possible only after one has controlled the senses. These verses remind the sadhaka that he should not be disappointed by the results of his sadhana if he fails once, twice, or even many times. Constant effort will help him to attain his goal. When his wants and desires are abandoned, then alone will he experience freedom. Verses 62 and 63.
Yayato vishayan pumsaha sangasteshu pajayate. Sangat sanjayate kamaha, kamat krodho bijayate. Krodhat bhavati sammohaha, sammohat smriti vibhramaha, smriti bhraunshat buddhinasho, buddhinashat pranashyati.
As a person contemplates the objects of the senses, there arises in him an attachment to them. From attachment arises desire. From desire, anger is produced. From anger comes delusion. From delusion, the confusion of memory and loss of mindfulness. From the disappearance of memory and mindfulness, the loss of the faculty of discrimination. By loss of the faculty of discrimination, one perishes. If one who constantly thinks of satisfying his desires for sensory gratification finds any hindrance or opposition to the fulfillment of his desires, he becomes frustrated. That frustration leads to anger toward that which is frustrating him. Unfulfilled desire or dissatisfaction is thus the cause of anger. When one becomes angry, he forgets to use discrimination and his memory wavers. That leads to the loss of reason, and one's mind becomes completely imbalanced. The downfall of a human being begins when he becomes preoccupied with the objects of sensory gratification and the enjoyment of those objects. Such a deluded person goes on collecting the objects of sense enjoyment. He becomes dependent on those objects, and gratification becomes the goal of his life. But his pursuit of pleasure creates self-degradation. Such a person is called a hedonist. When, for some reason, the objects of sense gratification are absent or not available, he becomes frustrated and angry. If two such people seek the same pleasure and desire the same object, they become enemies. For example, two great friends might kill each other if they are strongly attracted to and fall in love with the same woman. But two friends who are on the path of self-realization and share the same goal become even closer, because love for sensual objects is quite different from love for self-enlightenment. The first leads to selfishness, and the latter to selflessness. A selfish person is never able to conceive of the idea of selflessness, which is the singular expression of universal love. When we study the lives and sayings of great people, we find in them the quality of selflessness, no matter what their religious or cultural background might be. Ahimsa, non-injury, and selflessness are common characteristics of these great people, whereas selfishness and violence are the symptoms of those who do not remember the self, who are preoccupied with and engrossed in sense gratification. Verses 64 and 65.
Raga dvesha vyuktaistu vishayan indriyais charan atma vashyair videyatma prasadam adigacchati. Prasade sarva dukkhanam hanirasyopajayate. Prasanna chetasokhyashu buddhi paryavatishtate.
Conducting oneself with the senses, towards the objects of the senses, however, free of attraction and aversion, and under control of the self, one cultivating the self attains a healthy and pleasant state of mind. Upon attaining such pleasantness of mind, there is a diminution of all sorrows. The intelligence of a person of such a pleased mind attends quickly upon him. Sanyama, self-discipline, helps the sadhaka all the time. One who does not believe in self-discipline cannot attain profound knowledge of the self. Sense gratifications are only momentarily pleasurable. The moment the pleasurable object vanishes, the pleasure disappears as well. And when pleasurable objects are absent, one experiences pain. Attachment to the objects of the world is therefore the source of both pleasure and pain. Tranquility is experienced by the mind that is free from desire for sense gratification. The mind is ordinarily the slave of the senses that are employed by it. But when the mind has control over the senses, it has the power to discriminate right from wrong, and that which is helpful from that which is distracting. A steady, stable, equable mind is a peaceful mind, and a peaceful mind alone is free from grief. The mind that is free from grief and sorrow and from distractions and dissipations creates a forceful will. With the use of that will, one has tremendous success in attaining his goal. A dissipated mind has no will, but a concentrated and one-pointed mind creates willpower. A student with a weak and feeble will is not successful in his sadhana because of distractions. But the student whose mind is concentrated and one-pointed has a firm and determined will force that makes him courageous and fearless and able to remove all sorts of obstacles and barriers. Modern students are afraid of discipline. They fail to understand its meaning and dismiss it. They have the misconception that discipline is a sort of punishment imposed on them by those in authority. Therefore, the moment they hear the word discipline, they leave. But without discipline, control of the mind is impossible. And without control of the mind, one-pointedness is not possible. Therefore, there is no willpower, no courage, no fearlessness, For these qualities successively evolve from the practice of self-discipline. Modern students have a desire to seek, but they constantly bathe in material waters and find delights in the pleasures they experience there. Preoccupied with sense gratification, their desire to know truth is never fulfilled. They think of going in one direction, but all the while they are going the other way. The sadhaka needs to understand that mind, action, and speech should be directed toward one goal. A division should not be created by having a desire to seek the truth while still pursuing the enjoyment of sense gratification. The way one desires is the way one should think, and the way one thinks is the way he should act. Otherwise, a serious division is created within. Verses 66 through 68.
Nasti buddhira yuktasya, nacha yuktasya bhavana, nacha bhaveta shantir ashantasya kutasukham. Indriyanam hi charatam yenmanonu vidhiyate, tadasya harati pragnyam vayur navamivambhasi. Tasmadyasya mahabaho nigruhitani sarvashaha indriyan indriyarthebhyas tasya pragnya pratishtita.
There is no discriminating wisdom in one who is not joined in yoga, nor is there any cultivating of contemplativeness for one who is not joined in yoga. One who has not cultivated contemplation has no peace. How can there be happiness for one who is not at peace? The mind that is applied to following the wandering senses, indeed, such a mind plunders his wisdom as wind blows a boat in the water. Therefore, O mighty armed one, he whose senses, one and all, are held in control and held back from their objects, his wisdom is established. Pure reason is the essential means to discriminate the truth from the non-truth, the eternal from the non-eternal. That discrimination helps one to become non-attached to the objects of the world. When one resolutely practices sadhana, he attains the power of non-attachment, and when one is non-attached, he has full concentration. One who has full concentration attains a one-pointed mind and can utilize all of his human resources. He is able to experience peace, and peace brings happiness. That happiness is not the same as the pleasure received from the objects of sense gratification. Pleasure is a joy experienced through the senses, whereas happiness is an outcome of the state of tranquility. The human body is like a chariot in which the individual self is seated. Human intelligence is the charioteer, and the mind is the reins. The senses are the horses leading the chariot towards the objects of sensory enjoyment. The wise man who is able to make his mind tranquil stands firm and leads the chariot on the path to enlightenment, whereas the unwise lack the wisdom of yoga and are unable to control the senses. Untrained horses are unreliable, but trained horses lead the chariot on the path to enlightenment. Thus, the wise man learns to master the senses. He attains freedom, but he who is unwise and uncontrolled is trapped by the snares of births and deaths. Verse 69.
Yanisha sarva bhutanam tasyam jagrati sanyami yasyam jagrati bhutani sa nisha pasyato mune.
That which is night to the ordinary human being is day to the wise, and that in which the ordinary human being remains awake is night to the wise one who sees. This verse contains unique wisdom. The behavior of the sadhaka and yogi is explained by saying that that which is night to the ordinary human being is day to the wise, and that which is night to the wise is day to the ignorant. The song of life of the sadhaka is well understood and assimilated in this verse. The song of life is the eternal song, and the entire music of the cosmos forms an orchestra that plays one and the same song with many variations. The wise person is able to hear that song by making his whole being an ear. That song is not heard by the ignorant one, for he is busy listening to the gross, jarring, nerve-shattering, and disturbing sounds of contemporary society. The sadhakas who have experienced the higher dimensions of life, who are able to have a glimpse of the eternal, and who have touched the infinite, are awakened to the truth. But others remain sleeping, unaware of truth. While the ordinary man identifies himself with the worldly activities of the day, the sage remains unaffected by the mundane happenings and finds his joy in quiet hours late at night. Ordinary people do not know how to utilize the calm, serene stillness of the night. But the yogis enjoy this calmness in the practice of samadhi. For them, night drops the blossoms of their sadhana, and they pick up those blossoms dropped by night. Such fortunate sadhakas are blessed. Those rare ones sleep in the daytime and remain awake at night. For ordinary and ignorant people, that is an impossibility. Those whose feet walk in the light have a peculiar but wonderful way of using the span of life that is not understood by ordinary people. When everyone in the world remains sleeping, sadhakas remain awake. And when the whole world is awake and preoccupied with the pursuit of sensory pleasure and selfish ends, the sadhaka sleeps. He remains unaffected and uninfluenced by the rush and roar and distractions created by the day. Sri Krishna hints at the differences in the thinking and behavior of these two kinds of people. The enlightened ones, true seekers and sadhakas who are constantly aware of the truth, and the ignorant, who are totally unaware, who chew the weed that grows in the water to quench their thirst, rather than drinking the water. The external allurements do contain pleasures, but they have no capacity to quench the thirst. The thirst for happiness is the perennial thirst of man. It is only quenched by the knowledge of the real self. Verses 70 through 72.
Apuryamanam achalapratishtham samudramapa pravishanti yadvat tadvat kamayam pravishanti sarve sa shantim apnoti na kama kami vihaya kaman yas sarvan pumamscharati nispruha nirmamo nirahankaraha sa shantim adigacchati esha brahmi sthite partha nainam prapya vimukhyati
As waters enter the ocean, which is totally full, yet whose basin and boundaries remain stable, he whom all the desires enter similarly attains peace, and not one who desires the desires. The person who wanders free of attachment, having abandoned all desire, devoid of ego, and of the concept of mine, he attains peace. This is the godly state, O son of Prita. Attaining this, one is no longer confused. Remaining in it, even at the final hour, one finds absorption into Brahman. The aspirant who has attained calmness and serenity is like the infinite sky, in which storms, winds, and lightning may rage, but which have no power to disturb the serenity of the infinite. Similarly, the storms of desires and emotions pass through the mind, but are not at all able to disturb the tranquility of the realized yogi. Ironically enough, one who leads a pleasure-oriented life is usually miserable, whereas the yogi who has perfect self-control and has attained a state of calmness knows the joyous art of living and being, which enables him to walk on this earth without being affected by the so-called charms and temptations of the world. Sri Krishna teaches Arjuna that this is the state of mind of one who has realized the self. Such a self-realized human being is not subject to delusion, dejection, or despondency. Even at the crucial hour, he remains undisturbed, for he identifies himself with his essential nature, Brahman, instead of identifying himself with the ego and the objects of the world. The man who is free from egocentric I-ness and my-ness performs his duties skillfully and joyfully. Such an enlightened one develops an entirely different attitude toward life, relationships, and objects. He does not identify with the objects of the world, and therefore lives in the midst of so-called possessions while maintaining his aloofness. The ordinary man, however, is in the habit of identifying himself with the objects of the world. He clings to his possessions and develops an attachment for them. He is not certain that he will attain what he desires, and always remains afraid that he might lose what he possesses. The fear of not gaining what he wants, and the fear of losing what he possesses, makes him miserable. But the yogi, who has attained the state of equanimity, tranquility, and equilibrium, knows that the objects of the world should be used only as means, without a sense of attachment. They should not be allowed to dissipate the mind. What is there to possess? Great ones are great because they develop willpower, so that sense gratification and the sense of possessing things completely lose their value. This attitude comes after complete self-transformation. One then lives in the world, discharging his normal duties without being affected. Such a man is always aware of the truth that he has come to this world as a traveler on a long voyage. He is always like a guest in this world. Such a traveling guest does not carry a burden on his back, because the traveling would then become a painful experience. He always remembers that life is like a crowded bazaar, and he devises a method of traveling through that bazaar without being hurt or hurting others. As a guest lives in someone's home without disturbing the members of the family, the traveler thinks, "I am a guest here for a brief stay. Nothing belongs to me." With that attitude, there are no chances of becoming attached to the things and relationships of the world. For a true traveler, the world is a base camp, where he can compose and gather his resources for the onward journey. Actually, we are all travelers through this world. Let us not become attached to it. As a mountaineer has a base camp where he prepares himself to go to the summit, so is the case with us and our stay in the world. Let us make our journey pleasant and facilitative, instead of becoming lost. A sadhaka who has attained a state of equilibrium knows that death, which is horrifying for the ordinary person, creates a wonderful melody, like a mother singing a lullaby to put her tired and weary baby into a deep sleep. As a short sleep gives rest to the tired baby, who then awakens refreshed, death gives rest to the worn, tired traveler, who awakens reclothed in a new garb to continue on his way. Death, for a sage, is merely a change. He assumes a new garment and comes back to his path to continue his journey to the infinite. Death has no power to deviate the attention of such a great man. He maintains his consciousness of Brahman, here and hereafter. Thus ends the second chapter, in which Sri Krishna awakens Arjuna from his deep anguish. In this chapter, the dialogue between Sri Krishna and Arjuna encompasses the philosophy of Sankhya and the practical method of yoga science.